Psalm 127 is one of 15 songs of ascents that apparently were sung in ancient Israel as they approached the temple or approached Jerusalem during the festival periods, during those times of journeying, pilgrimage festivals. Some reports say there were 15 steps leading up to the temple or leading up to the temple area, and that choirs of singers from the temple would sing a different one of these songs of ascent each day as it got near the feast. Others say it was the Israelites themselves who used to sing these songs on their way as they journeyed toward Jerusalem. I'd like to turn to Psalm 127 and notice what we read there. Psalm 127. It's a rather short psalm, only five verses. But I want to start in verse 3. It says, "Behold, children are a heritage from the Lord. The fruit of the womb is a reward, like arrows in the hand of a warrior, so are the children of one's youth. Happy is the man who has his quiver full of them. They shall not be ashamed, but shall speak with their enemies in the gate." Now, this song of ascent, if you notice the title above the first verse or above the psalm, this says that it was of Solomon, the song of ascent of Solomon. It's the only one attributed to Solomon. And he says children are a heritage. They are a blessing from God. They're special to God. I realize there are some, or were some, cultural issues in patriarchal times about having children, and some of those are still felt today about children and the ability to have children. But in general, God is calling them and refers to them as a very wonderful thing, as a beautiful thing, a blessing, a heritage. Unfortunately, there are many in our culture today, a large part of our society, where the view has changed and they're seen as a nuisance, or they're seen as a burden, or they're seen as a detriment in some way. And that's really a terrible, terrible, sad thing. But God is very positive about children, and we should be as well. Hebrews chapter 2 tells us that, in one sense, children is what God's plan is all about. We have read this verse, or this passage, these couple of verses several times in recent years, the last few years, but I think it's important to go back and make this point again. Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 9 says, "But we see Jesus, who was made a little lower than the angels for the suffering of death, crowned with glory and honor, that he, by the grace of God, might taste death for everyone, because it was fitting for him, for whom are all things, and by whom are all things, in bringing many sons to glory, to make the captain of their salvation perfect through sufferings." Now, this is especially fitting today, isn't it? Because it talks about children, and it talks about bringing many sons to glory, that this is what God is in the process of doing. Through the sacrifice of Jesus Christ, he makes it possible for God to bring many children into his family, to bring them into the family of God, to be a part of the heritage of God. So I'd like to talk a little bit about heritage today. Heritage is a word that has a number of meanings. In fact, if you look it up in a dictionary, you'll find several different meanings. But heritage essentially means something that is passed on from generation to generation. That's the basic meaning of it. It could be any number of things. It could be tangible. It could be intangible. It could be property, material things. It could be real property or money, possessions of some type. It could be influence, which is an intangible. It could be status. It could even be a custom or tradition, things that are more intangible in nature. But it's something that's passed on, and it's something that's viewed as a positive thing. Now, I debated back and forth about how to present this today, but I would like to start by looking at the Bible's usage of the word heritage. God uses it in the Bible in several different ways, several of these ways that I've already mentioned. It shows up about 30 times in the English or in the King James, New King James translation, about 30 times, so we won't cover them all, but just a few representative passages that are a sampling. I'd like to go first to Exodus chapter 6. Exodus chapter 6. Now, I think by going to this chapter, most of you immediately know that we're looking at the time period when Israel was still in Egypt. They were slaves in Egypt. They were about to be freed, but it wasn't happening instantly. It was not the next morning that they were going to wake up and be free. God had sent Moses to be the one to lead them out of captivity. And when Moses went and discussed things with Pharaoh, you probably recall it didn't go so good the first time, right? didn't go so well. Pharaoh said, oh, they're lazy. That's why they want to go sacrifice out in the wilderness and worship their God. Tell you what, take the straw away. Make them go get their own straw. Don't let them slack off on their production at all. Don't miss a single brick. But make them go get their own straw now instead of you bringing it to them. As we read in verse 8 of this chapter, Moses is talking to the people, and he says in chapter 6 of Exodus and verse 8, "And I will bring you into the land which I swore to give to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and I will give it to you as a heritage. I am the Lord." These were words directly from God that said, look, you're not real happy right now, but I am going to take you to that place. I am going to give you the land I promised Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I'm going to take you there. It's going to be your heritage. You'll pass it on from generation to generation to generation. It will be something that is a blessing from me. I'm the Lord. I will make this happen. Now the next verse, of course, Moses so spoke to the children of Israel, but they did not heed Moses because of their anguish of spirit and cruel bondage. So this is probably the most common way we think of in terms of the word heritage, that it's something that's passed along, a possession perhaps that's passed along, real or a monetary property that's passed on from generation to generation. God had Moses tell the children that he would make good on his promise and that they would inhabit that land. He would take them there. He would give it to them to pass on to their descendants. So they were a little short-sighted, though, the Israelites. They couldn't see past the immediate problem of trying to make the same number of bricks and have to go gather their own straw. So they were not exactly overwhelmed by God's statement or by Moses' statement. They couldn't see beyond the present. That's not unusual. How many of us keep that vision of the future firmly in mind at all times today? Even with God's Spirit, sometimes it's hard. Sometimes we get bogged down in the issues of today and tomorrow and next week and don't look long term. Young people in particular have a very, very difficult time with this. To a baby, "I'll feed you in a minute," is an eternity, right? They want it right now. They don't know what a minute means. They have no concept that, yes, you will feed them in 1 minute. Give me 60 seconds, and you will be fed. A three-year-old, tomorrow is an eternity. You know, they just don't have that concept of looking into the future. As we get to be adults, we're supposed to have that ability to look better into the future. And, of course, we just came back from the feast, which was a good boost to give us all that vision of the future and remind us of what God plans to do with this planet, what he plans to do for mankind. He wants all of us to develop that distance vision and to trust him when he says something is going to happen. Well, let's go to Psalm 94. We'll find another usage of the use of the word heritage. This is one property that would be passed from generation to generation. God obviously spoke in multi-generations when he spoke about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. These were successive generations of his people. Remember, he made the covenant with Abraham and said, "You are my people, your descendants are my people. You'll be as many as the sand of the seashore." And there were several generations that went by. And so he was speaking in terms of generation, but he was specifically speaking in terms of heritage in being the land. That will be your heritage. Now, in Psalm 94, verse 3, because this gives a little bit of the heading or the context of this statement. "Lord, how long will the wicked triumph? They utter speech, they speak insolent things. All the workers of iniquity boast in themselves. They break in pieces your people, O Lord, and afflict your heritage." So you see, here the word heritage does not have to do with property. Here the word heritage has to do with the people, the children of Israel. He said, how long will you going to allow these wicked people to do these things? They break in people, break in pieces your people. They afflict your heritage. So God's people are seen as His heritage. He speaks of them in that sense. His heritage, an ongoing people, an ongoing nation, generation after generation. Jeremiah and several of the minor prophets used this word heritage in that same way when they spoke about God's heritage. So let's look at one of those. I'm not going to read any of the others, but in the book of Joel, turn with me to Joel. Book of Joel, chapter 3. Joel is a book that has a lot to say about the day of the Lord and some of the events of end times. But in Joel 3, we find in verse 2 that God inspired Joel to write this. He says, I will also gather all nations and bring them down to the valley of Jehoshaphat. And I will enter into judgment with them there on account of my people, my heritage Israel, whom they have scattered among the nations. They've also divided up my land and have cast lots for my people. So God himself speaks of his people, his heritage, and he names them specifically as Israel. So this is another usage. Yes, it was the land. That was to be a heritage generation after generation, but the people of Israel were to be the heritage of God. He called them his heritage. Now let's go to Psalm 119. And this is the last one we'll look at in the Old Testament here, but Psalm 119. Now, Psalm 119 is a long chapter that talks about God's way, God's truth, God's law. A lot of things that are described in this chapter. And we can see in about verse 105, 107, he talks about God's law and commandments, 107 and 8. Verse 105 talks about his word as being a lamp to guide our path of life, to illuminate where we need to go and how we need to live. But let's read verse 111. This is the one that talks about heritage. Psalm 119, verse 111. Your testimonies I have taken as a heritage forever, for they are the rejoicing of my heart. Your testimonies, your teaching, your truth, your way, the understanding of your words, God, these are a great treasure. These are a treasured possession. Intangible in that sense, because they're words. Of course, they were written down, but they are words that are passed on from generation to generation. And the implication is that he's going to pass them on to his children, to the descendants after him. But he views God's word, God's testimonies, God's teaching as a treasured possession to be handed down from generation to generation. But there's only one place in the New Testament, at least in the King James translation, where heritage is used. So let's take a look at that one. It's in 1 Peter. And I think it's good for us to look at this because sometimes in the Old Testament and the New Testament, there's a little bit of change in the way certain things are described or done or are viewed. But this shows that God still views his people in the New Testament as his heritage. As Paul said, I believe it was in Galatians, where he talked about peace being on the Israel of God when he's speaking about the church and the New Testament Christians. Here, Peter also makes a similar kind of a statement. In 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 1, Peter writes and he says, the elders who are among you, I exhort, I who am a fellow elder and a witness of the sufferings of Christ and also a partaker of the glory that will be revealed. And here's its instruction to them, starting in verse 2, shepherd the flock of God, which is among you, serving as overseers, not by compulsion, not because you're forced to, but willingly, being happy to do it. Not for dishonest gain, but eagerly. Not as being lords, so this is a series of contrasts, not this way, but this, not this, but that. not as being lords over those entrusted to you, but being examples to the flock. Now, it's that phrase, those entrusted to you. If anyone has a King James translation, you'll see it mentions there as a heritage. Being lords over those entrusted to you, but being an example to the flock. New King James says, those entrusted to you, and it's clear that God is speaking about His New Testament people in the church. That elders are not supposed to lord it over them and grind people down, those who are entrusted in their care. But God views them, His people, in a very special way. They are His heritage. Now, from that quick survey of the use of the word heritage and seeing that God views His people in terms of that, there really shouldn't be any doubt in terms of God's desire that the relationship He has with His people should be passed down from generation to generation, that He would like to have that same relationship with your children and my children, that that's His desire, that's His goal. In other words, God's whole intent in beginning with Abraham was to have generation after generation after generation that were His heritage, His people, and that would have a good relationship with Him. Remember all the way back in Genesis 12, God called Abraham and said He would give him the land of Canaan, or that He would give the land of Canaan actually to Abraham and to his descendants. You know, again, generationally, on to your descendants. Let's turn to that famous passage where God expresses His confidence in Abraham for successive generations. Now, I'll make a comment or two in a minute about the fact that this is God's ideal, and we know that ultimately we all have a choice, and our children have a choice as well. It's not something that's demanded or that we can demand of them, but this is what God desires. In verse 18, we find that God had come to Abraham. Ishmael would have been about 13 years of age at this particular point in Genesis chapter 18. And God promised, He had just promised to Abraham that He would have a son, not by Hagar, but that He would have a son by Sarah, that the two of them would have a son. And notice what He says in verse 17, he asked, should I hide from Abraham what I'm doing, since Abraham will surely become a great and mighty nation? No question about it. And all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him. For, here's the reason, verse 19, because I have known him, in order that he may command his children and his household after him, that they keep the way of the Lord to do righteousness and justice, that the Lord may bring to Abraham what he has spoken to him. Now, I know we don't live in a patriarchal system today, but in those days it was a patriarchal system, and the family tended to stay together. From generation to generation, they tended to stay together. And it was easier for God to make that statement. I know what Abraham's going to do. He's going to command his children after him, and the next generation, the next generation, the next generation. And they'll be my people. Heard something fall. Don't know if that was me or what it was. But it would be generation after generation. What if Isaac had suddenly decided he wanted to go seek gold in South Africa or somewhere on the African continent? Well, he didn't do it, did he? In our society today, sometimes we tend to have a little bit more freedom than those types of things. What if he didn't want to seek Abraham's God? Well, Abraham seemed to know that Isaac would. God seemed to know that Isaac would. And you look at Isaac and you see his history. And what I read of his history is that it seems that Isaac tended to keep that vision. But it didn't take long, and there were some bumps in the road. The next generation, Jacob, it took a little bit of work. If you remember the story of Jacob and Esau, Jacob had some lessons to learn before he finally got the vision. It wasn't an immediate thing that it seems he was in line with what God's intent was. It seems to have taken him a little bit. And Joseph, there was another whole issue, wasn't there? Now, there were some parental issues going on and favoritism, and I don't mean to get into all of that detail of their lives, but both of them, Jacob and Joseph, eventually came around. They focused on God as their ancestor Abraham had. And God said He knew that that would be the case. when Israel was finally getting close to entering the promised land, let's turn to Deuteronomy, the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 6. Notice God's instruction through Moses. I think most of us could probably recite this by heart. We know what this passage says. But in Deuteronomy chapter 6, again, God's intent was that generationally, from generation to generation, they would be taught his way. They would be taught about him and build a relationship with him. In Deuteronomy 6 and verse 4, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God," the Lord is one, he is the only God, "you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength. And these words which I command you today shall be in your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children, and shall talk of them when you sit in the house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise up." So God expected Israel to be diligent in teaching about him to their children. This is something God expected of them and about God's way, because he wanted the children to enjoy the land, and their children after them, and the children after their children. God's view was a long-term successive thing for generation after generation. Last year before our camp conference, I was struck by a passage that speaks about this principle of heritage, generation after generation. It's Psalm 78. I'm going to turn there. I printed this on the top of my overview letter to the camp team in the handout. And in fact, several picked up on it during the conference. Mr. Franks did as well and made some comments about it that were used in the camp video. But this passage in Psalm 78, we'll pick it up in verse 1. He says, "Give ear, O my people, to my law. Incline your ears to the words of my mouth. I will open my mouth in a parable. I will utter dark sayings of old, which we've heard and known, and our fathers have told us. We will not hide them from their children, telling to the generation to come the praises of the Lord and his strength and his wonderful works that he's done. For he, God, has established a testimony in Jacob and appointed a law in Israel, which he commanded our fathers, that they, the fathers, should make them known to their children. Verse 6, that the generation to come might know them, the children who would be born, that they may arise and declare them to their children, that they may set their hope in God and not forget the works of God, but keep his commandments." This is a beautiful passage that shows this is God's desire to fathers, to the children, and to their children, and the children after them. That they remember God, they think about God, they focus on God. God wants all of us to be a precious heritage to him. Me and you and our children and our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren, our great-great-grandchildren, that's his goal, that's his desire, that's what he wants. And as Christians, we probably all want the same thing. But I think most of us realize we cannot guarantee it any more than God could guarantee that each successive generation of ancient Israel would build that relationship with him. We don't have those guarantees. We need to do our part in making it easy for them to choose the relationship with God, but we can't guarantee it. And that desire for generations didn't end in the Old Testament. One passage in the New Testament makes it clear, Acts chapter 2. And then we'll go from concept to application. Acts chapter 2, this was on the day of Pentecost when the Holy Spirit was given, the New Testament church was established, and we find that Peter gives this sermon. At the end of the sermon, people were cut to the heart when they realized that Jesus was the Messiah and that they had crucified him, and they asked, "What do we do?" And Peter's answer in verse 38 was, "Repent and let every one of you be baptized in the name of Jesus Christ for the remission of sins, and you shall receive the gift of the Holy Spirit. For," there again is that word "for," which means "because the promise is to you and to your children and to all who are afar off, as many as the Lord our God will call." So again, God's promises clearly are multi-generational. That's his desire. That's his goal. Now, that's the theory that God lays out in the Bible of what he wants to see. It's what he would like to see. Over the years, I have looked for God's step-by-step lesson plan of how to make that happen. And as those of you who are teachers among us know, a lesson plan really gives you the outline, tells you exactly how to do it. I don't find it anywhere. Don't find it in the Bible. You and I both can name adults who have not remained part of the heritage of God, at least as best we can tell. You can certainly name children as well. Why is that? Well, if I had a very clear scientific answer, I'd be in great demand in the church. Probably wouldn't be here. I'd be out all over the place, wouldn't I? Trying to teach people this very specific scientific way of doing it. What I'd like to do and share in the rest of this message today about being a heritage are some of the things I have learned about parenting. Some of the things that I've learned about parenting after my children were grown. Wouldn't it be nice if I knew when my first child was born what I know now? Sure wish I knew that. But I didn't. We only know what we know at the time. So far, Kathy and I have been very pleased with the overall outcome of our lives and our children's lives. We feel very, very blessed. And I use the word so far very deliberately, because I realize, as Paul said, all of us must be careful to make sure we remain faithful. First of all, we can't make anyone else remain faithful, but we have to remain faithful so that we don't become cast away, as Paul said he could become. So I don't say this as a matter of pride. I say it as a matter of blessing, and I say it that so far I'm pleased. Our children obviously have to make their own choices. And they must do that for themselves also, remain faithful. What I have learned is that whenever there are human beings involved, there are no guarantees. We're all free moral agents. We're all free to choose what we want. Now, sometimes we think we're choosing what we want, and we don't get what we think we're going to get because our choice is not a wise choice. And that's not directed at anyone sitting in front of me. It's directed at me as well, because every one of us sometimes does that. We make a choice and think, well, this is going to be a good outcome, and it's not the way we expected it to turn out. So we all have things to learn in this. And one of the things that I try to encourage parents about is, remember, children, first of all, are the children of God. And ultimately, He's the one that has to work with them to bring them to Him. And over the years, I have been very pleasantly surprised to find people from time to time who I knew in my youth as a part of the church who left and never heard anything about for decades, to suddenly see them at a Feast of Tabernacles. A few years ago, that happened in Kerrville. I saw someone that I frankly had forgotten about my childhood, back at the Feast of Tabernacles, first time in about 30-some years. This year, Kathy was telling me about an Imperial School alumni. This year was her first year, or his first year back after 35 years to attend the Feast of Tabernacles again. So I want to make the point very clear that our children, first and foremost, are children of God. God can work with them, and sometimes does, if they're willing to be worked with. Having said that, over the past decade or so, we've taught several classes of Growing Kids God's Way. And while it's not a perfect program, in every class that I go through, I make comments along the way, well, this concept's not quite right because it's based on a wrong view of humanity. It's based on a wrong view of God's plan. But a lot of the principles that they teach are things that, as I said, I wish I had known earlier in my children's life. Some of the things we did, some of the things we didn't do. But I've learned some very good principles in dealing with children over the years and from that program as well. I'd like to share a few of them with you today. Perhaps we can teach the whole class again at some point, since the foundation starts with birth to age 5. It's kind of the foundational period of their program. But I'd like to talk about a couple of principles that I took away from that course years ago that I think are very important principles. Number one, the Ezos, who developed Growing Kids God's Way, introduce the principle of moral training. Moral training. This is one of the things they introduced very early in their program. Moral training. They talk about the issues of parenting styles. They talk about authoritarian parenting and permissive parenting. Both approaches to parenting have some immediate results that sometimes seem to be good. Authoritarian parenting, yeah, they'll obey you to your face, but there's bad consequences sometimes down the line. Permissive parenting, things seem peaceful. You give them everything they want, seems good for a while, but that turns out to be a disaster also. So neither of those is a good result. It just doesn't work out. The answer is somewhere in between, which they try to teach in the rest of the course. And they describe it as something that works to teach and works to control and help a child control both the outside and the inside, both the actions and the mind, the character of the child. Without turning to a lot of scriptures in the church, we recognize that God is the ultimate decider. He is the ultimate arbiter of right and wrong. He is the source of morality. This book, His written word, is our source for life. It is our source for right and wrong. Man early on chose the tree of the knowledge of good and evil to decide for himself, and we know that's not the right approach. It's not society. It's not what we feel is right and wrong. There are moral absolutes. And God's the one that gives them. He's the one that has the right to give them. One of the things the Essos point out, though, is that absolutes are not altered by personality, temperament, or gender. Sometimes as parents we want to make excuses for our children. Oh, well, she's just so shy. You know, that's why she, when I tell her to tell you hi, she won't tell you hi. She's just so shy. Well, that's not an excuse for disobeying your parent. Shyness is not an excuse. Temperament is not an excuse. Personality is not an excuse. Frankly, sometimes we make excuses for ourselves as adults. I did wrong because, and then we blame something. Well, that's the reason I did what I did. Their focus, I think, is right in that there are absolutes. Obviously, personality can adjust the personality and temperament can sometimes adjust the way we deal with a child and the way in which we instruct and teach. But it's not a substitute for right and wrong. With God, right is always right, wrong is always wrong. Now, that said, sometimes there are variations in how we apply principles and which principle to apply. And in my mind, that's really where the rubber hits the road. Which principle do I apply in this situation? For example, let me give you a good case in point. Turn with me to Proverbs chapter 26. Proverbs chapter 26. Some of us like absolutes. Absolute, always. Absolute, always. But sometimes God gives us two principles and says, you must decide which of these principles to apply in a particular situation. See, that's where the issue of depth of understanding as a parent and trying to teach that to a child comes into play in this. Proverbs chapter 26, verse 4 says this, do not answer a fool according to his folly, lest you also be like him. There it is. Shut the book. We got it, right? Don't answer a fool or you'll be just like him. So when people make ridiculous comments about your beliefs, just keep your mouth shut, don't answer them, walk away, and that solves everything. Well, until you read the next verse, it might seem so. Verse 5 says, answer a fool according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own eyes. You have two absolute opposites. Do not answer a fool and answer a fool. One verse right after the other. So which principle do you apply? See, that's where discernment comes in, isn't it? That's where it gets difficult sometimes to decide. Don't answer a fool when you would only end up looking like him, being argumentative, fighting. You know, you don't want to answer a fool if that's the case going to be, if that's what the case is going to be. On the other hand, he says, answer a fool. lest he go away conceited that he knows better than you and that he knows better than God. Answer him. Don't let him go away thinking he's smarter than God when he's got you figured out as a fool. How do we know the difference? Well, it's discernment. And that, how do we get discernment? Often it's based on experience, isn't it? You try it a few times and you figure out which ones work and which ones don't. Is there a basis for that approach in the Bible? Is there a basis for learning by experience? Well, sure there is. Turn to Hebrews chapter 5. Found it interesting in the sermonette. We heard about meat, milk. Hebrews 5 talks about meat and milk also. And look at the principle that we're told here. The very end of the chapter, verse 5, I'm not going to get into a lot of this other than to just make this point. Verse 13, everyone who partakes only of milk is unskilled in the word of righteousness, for he's a babe. But, verse 14, solid food, or some, I think it's the King James says meat, strong meat, solid food, belongs to those who are of full age. That is, those who by reason of use have their senses exercised to discern both good and evil. Now some read this and say, ha, see, there's my excuse. I get to go practice all the evil stuff so I can discern it, so I can know it. And that's not what he's saying. And that's a carnal way of looking at this. What it's saying is we learn the good response and the not so good response, the way not to do it. The Greek word for use, by reason of use, the Greek word for use is hexis. The lexicons say this word means habit. It means something that is acquired by use and by practice. That you do it, you practice it, and you acquire this as a habit. You learn it. And applying that understanding to these verses in Proverbs would mean that when someone makes a stupid comment about your beliefs, you have to make some pretty quick assessments of several things. You have to try to discern the tone of voice. What's the tone of voice that person is using? Are they sincere in what they're saying or what they're asking? Is it mocking? Is it argumentative? What's the context of their statement or question? Is it a context that would call for an answer? Is it a context that's just a, you know, passing comment, and the context is, let it go. Nothing's going to be achieved by responding to that. They've already moved on to six other subjects by the time you think of what you would want to say anyway, so just let it go. What's the context? What's the character of that person? Are they a belligerent kind of person? Are they the kind of person that really wants to know what you think and what you believe? All of these things come into play. What's the background of that person? And based on all of those, and probably more input, you have to make a decision. If I answer, will we end up in an argument and both look like fools? Or will this person take my response well? Will they take it well? On the other hand, if I keep silent, will that have bad consequences with this person going away conceited about himself? That wouldn't necessarily be good. You also have to consider how you are going to answer, because we're told our words should always be seasoned with salt, with grace, aren't they? So we got a lot of things to think about in that split instance when we're trying to make the decision, do I answer this person, do I not answer this person? But you see, that's where the discernment comes in. That's where the practice comes in. You try to take all of those things into account. You make a decision and say, I think I should say something, and I think this is what I should say. It doesn't put the person down, but it answers their immediate question. If they want more, they'll ask me for more. And you give that response, and you see what the reaction is. The next time you come up in the same kind of situation, you have a little bit of storehouse, you have a little bit of information in your knowledge base from which to make the decision the next time. If it blows up in your face, chalk it up as one, don't do that one again. At least not under those circumstances, or not with that person. That's where we learn. We learn to discern. Start to build what I call a database of information about how to apply each of those principles. And our challenge as parents is to learn how to teach our children the moral reason why they are to do. what they should do? What's the reason, either a moral or practical reason? Why is it appropriate to show honor and respect to older people? Why is it appropriate to do this? If we don't know the reason, we certainly can't teach our children, can we? As the Ezos make the point, you cannot lead your children past your own level of growth. That's where we as adults and we as parents certainly have to be growing ourselves. Teaching only what to do, but not also giving the moral or practical reason why, is a mistake. It's crucial to give that reason why, to explain to young children why you have them do what they're doing. Because it helps them build their character in a godly way. It builds their moral storehouse, if I can refer to it that way. Too many times, we as parents get focused on suppressing bad behavior. We get focused on suppressing the wrong behavior. And we don't encourage the good behavior enough. We hit on this much later than I wish we had known, with our children. Reinforce the positive, and you're going to get a whole lot better results than simply hammering the negative. I wish I'd have known that. Years younger would have helped, I believe. But the Ezos point that out, that many times parents are more focused on suppressing evil than elevating good. Teaching the reason the good should be done is important because it helps them learn a moral reason why. I'd like to turn to one scripture in this section about conscience and moral reason why. Let's go to 1 Samuel chapter 24. Really can't spend a lot of time developing this, but I do want to read this passage because I think it is very telling about David's conscience, that he had it in his mind the right behavior. And when he did the wrong behavior, his conscience struck him. It didn't, and your conscience can do several different things. I mean, it can reinforce, yeah, I did the right thing, but it can also strike you and say, you did the wrong thing. You know, it can reinforce the right, it can reinforce the wrong. It can warn you of the wrong. It can encourage you of doing the right. In this case, David was stricken in his heart because he had done something wrong. Psalm 20, 1 Samuel chapter 24, verse 1, it happened when Saul had returned from following the Philistines, it was told to him, look, David's in the wilderness in Gedi. He took 3,000 men, went to seek him. I won't read all of the details, but David was back in a cave, and Saul needed to relieve himself, so Saul goes into this cave. Now, verse 4. It says, then the men of David said to him, this is the day of which the Lord said to you, behold, I will deliver your enemy into your hand. Look, God's given him to your hand. He's trying to kill you. Go take his life, David, in this madness. We're tired of running in the wilderness out here in the desert, in the wilderness places. And the last part of verse 4 says, and David arose and secretly cut off a corner of Saul's robe. He didn't kill him. He just cut off part of his robe. Secretly cut part of it off. And verse 5 says, now it happened afterward that David's heart troubled him because he had cut Saul's robe. And he said to his men, the Lord forbid that I should do this thing to my master, the Lord's anointed, to stretch out my hand against him, seeing he is the anointed of the Lord. And David restrained his servants with these words, and he did not allow them to rise against Saul. And Saul got up from the cave and went on his way. Why did David's heart trouble him? Why did it smite him? Why did he get upset in himself for what he had done? What was his conscience bothered by? From him even cutting off a piece of the robe, of Saul's robe. He certainly didn't kill him. Saul was trying to kill David, so wouldn't it be okay to let his anger loose and go ahead and kill Saul? After all, God had anointed David to be the next king. I mean, we could reason that way, but David didn't reason that way. David knew in his heart it was wrong to raise his hand against God's anointed. This is God's anointed. If God strikes him down some other way, that's God's doing. But it's not right for me to take it on myself to afflict God's anointed. It's not even right for me to cut off a chunk of his robe that would be an embarrassment to Saul. Walks around with a chunk of his robe missing. How does that look? David said, this isn't right. What I did isn't right. Now, David didn't have to cut off a part of his robe for Saul to know that David was hiding in the cave. All he had to do was come out after him and say, look, I could have killed you, which is what he did. He did tell him he cut off a part of his robe. But he didn't have to do that for Saul to know that he was in David's hands if David had wanted to kill him. David's conscience had been trained, and he knew the moral reason why he should not raise his hand against the king. It was an educated conscience. Now, related to this, but on a slightly higher overview perspective, I'd like to also share the point the Ezels made about stages or phases of parenting. I don't have time to get into a whole lot of other things, but I believe a lack of understanding of these phases is sometimes brings a lot of trouble within families. Now, this knowledge alone is not enough, because for this to work properly, you have to be applying it from the beginning, you know, from birth, early on. And most of us don't know this when our children are born. We're wrapped up in the time-consuming issues of infancy, feedings and sleeping and trying to get sleep yourself and missing sleep and sleep-deprived. So I think our daughter's still sleep-deprived, and hers are... Oldest is up to about six now, five, seven. I can't remember the age. Five and seven, there it is. Anyway, they're getting older, and she's still sleep deprived. You know, always stuff to do with young children around. But we get all wrapped up in those things, and don't think strategically about what should take place over the life of the child for the next 20 years. Because ultimately, that's our goal, isn't it, as parents? We really want to look toward the end goal. And it's not right now. It's not tomorrow. It's not next week. It's not next year. It's 20 years from then, when they're out on their own. That's really what our end goal is as parents. And I look back when our children were little, and I sure didn't think that way. You know, I was thinking, I want to get by this particular issue, you know, and let's get life back to normal. Didn't think as strategically as I would have liked to. So I consider us to be very blessed that our children have been such a blessing to us, and we're able to enter that fourth stage. We had some rocky segments, I will admit that. Sometimes when we weren't sure whether we were going to get to that next phase, and get to that final phase. But I can't emphasize enough what a blessing it is to be at that stage. I wish we'd known more about these when we were younger, as I've said. And there may be other ways to express this. See, as those describe them this way, phase one is discipline. Discipline. When a child is very young, for them, they say it's from birth to, and again, temperament and personality and gender and different things can vary the age. They say roughly age five, four, five, six, somewhere in there. It's really about discipline. From birth to that age, when they're young, they literally have to learn everything. I mean, from birth, they don't know how not to mess their diaper. They don't know how to eat. They don't know how to talk. They don't know how to walk. They know nothing. Who was that? Hogan's hero, Schultz. I know nothing! Literally, they could say, I know nothing. And they were right. Well, then, no, they can't say that because they can't talk. But if they could talk, they could say that. At birth, they're totally dependent. I've heard it said before that our job as parents is to successfully help a child navigate that path from total dependence to near total independence. Near total, not totally independent, but near total independence. And that's sometimes a difficult path. In phase one, you're in total control of the child's life, and you must be. There have to be very tight boundaries. No, you don't stick your finger in light sockets. No, you don't do this. You know, you don't do that. Don't put your hand on the stove. All the issues that a child can face that are dangerous. You have to have tight boundaries, not a lot of freedoms. But freedoms begin, and they begin to come as he or she demonstrates responsible behavior. But the thing with that control must also be with loving authority and control. Can't be with an overbearing approach, oppressive, authoritative, but not authoritarian. And sadly, we humans sometimes have trouble distinguishing between those two. Authority, yes, but not authoritarian. God's definitely in charge, but he also describes himself as a loving God. And we need to learn to do that as well. Phase two, from 4, 5, 6, 7, somewhere in there, through about 10, 11, 12, 13, again, depends on the child, depends on their development, their emotional development, depends on their maturity level. But somewhere in that range should be what Bezos called the training mode. Training mode involves all kinds of different settings. If you put it in a, you know, I guess you could say like a trainer who is training someone in a sport, you have total control over the game. Little Johnny pushes somebody down. You stop. You go get Johnny. You get the other child. You talk to Johnny. We don't push because when you push, it hurts this child. Look at their knees. Look how skinned up they are. Now let's try this again. You took the toy because you wanted that toy. You pushed him out of the way to get the toy. Let's come back. Here we go. Sit down. The toy is his. Now, you ask him nicely, can you play with the toy? And if he says no, you say, okay, and I'll give you another toy. I mean, you walk him through the whole process. It's the teaching mode. You have total control of the child's life. And you try to teach them the right thing to do and why they need to do the right thing. At this point, of course, you've got to be on your game, constantly alert, to stop the game at any moment, to correct the wrong behavior. But you're in the training phase, still explaining the moral reason why the wrong was bad and why the good's appropriate, why it's the moral thing to do. It's a very, very active phase of parenting. And as you might guess, the next stage, which comes somewhere into the teen years up through, again, depending on maturity level, 18, 19, 20, 21, somewhere in that range, is what they call the coaching phase. You're no longer the trainer. You no longer stop life mid-game. Oh, you push them down. Wait, both of you come sit down. You don't do that with a teenager, do you? And now you're more in the coaching phase. You're a little bit more on the sidelines. They're out there living life, and you're watching what's going on. And obviously you've got some input that at times you want to give, and whether that input's going to be received or not is a good part is based on how well you've done your job as a trainer. When you've trained, have you trained with love? Have you trained with affection and kindness? Have you taught them the way where they can understand what you're saying and where it makes sense to them to understand why you want them to do certain things and not do other things? That time of coaching, teenage time, can sometimes be very rocky, but it can also be very rewarding when you see them make the right choices and you see them blessed for making the right choices. I can remember several of those and think, boy, it was really nice to see them do the right thing. Makes you feel good as a parent. The level of trust that you've developed in both of your early phases is really important in the coaching phase. Again, the kind of trainer you have been really determines how well they'll respond to that coaching. Have you proven yourself in all of those examples? Have you proven yourself to be a balanced, loving disciplinarian and a trainer? It has an impact on how much they value your coaching, again, to use the sports analogy. And finally, that fourth phase is friendship. Once he or she has reached the age of being a young adult, the parent-child relationship doesn't end. But it does change. It shifts into a friendship. It's a friendship level. When I was in my 20s and 30s, I didn't call my dad to ask permission to do something. It was no longer a matter of I was under his rule, but I called my dad because I valued him. I valued him as a friend. I valued him as a resource, as a giver of advice, of someone who had been through it before. Somebody who had experience. But I called him. I talked with him about things as a mentor. I wanted his advice because I valued his advice. He didn't seek to run my life. He didn't seek to run my family. He didn't seek to tell me how to raise my children. Well, had some advice at times, but he tried to interject that in a kind way, not an overbearing, ruling way. This is the ultimate goal of parenting, isn't it? The problem is way too many parents in our society today want to reach that goal when their children are 10 or 6. They want to be their friend It's not the time to be their friend. You're their parent. You're their trainer. And then you're their coach. And ultimately, when they are mature, you can enter that friendship age. Again, as I say, the ages are not hard and fast boundaries. They're landmarks. And how we transition from one to the next depends on how you, your spouse, your child, all of those relationships, depends on how they've all gone. Depends on how they've built, how they've been built. The transitions are gradual, but eventually they need to be made. But again, too many parents want to rush that last one. You have the rest of your life to be in the friendship phase. And that's a wonderful phase to be in, to realize now this is more of a peer. This is more of a friend. Yes, still my child. Kevin will always be my son. Kami will always be my daughter. But there's a different relationship, and it's a friendship relationship. Then we can be pleased with the heritage of mature, productive children who are a blessing to those around them and to us. And that is a heritage. That's a wonderful heritage for us, a wonderful heritage for our family name. I want you to consider John 15. I haven't turned to many scriptures here. I haven't wanted to drag this out too long. I want to start wrapping this up here. But John 15, I'd like you to consider this statement by Jesus Christ. The night before Jesus Christ was betrayed, he changed the phase of his relationship with the apostles. I don't know if you've looked at this and thought of it from that perspective, but he wanted to enter phase four at this point, to use his parenting style or parenting phase concept. In John chapter 15, he mentions in verse 13, greater love has no one than this, to lay down one's life for his friends. And he knew that that's what he was going to do. He was going to lay down his life for them and for you and me and for all humanity. Verse 14, he says, you are my friends if you do whatever I command you. No longer do I call you servants. Now, the fact that he says, no longer do I call you servants, means they were his servants for a while, that he did view them, that perspective. It was a perspective of a servant master. But he said, no longer do I call you servants, for a servant does not know what his master is doing. But I have called you friends, for all things that I heard from my Father, I have made known to you. It's as though Jesus is saying, now is the time for the transition into the friendship stage. We're moving from me being among you, with you, living with you. When Peter says, or who was it, the sons of thunder, James and John, shall we call down fire from heaven? You get to be the trainer and say, no, stop. We reset it. You don't know what you're saying. You're a son of Satan when you say stuff like that. That's what Satan does. He destroys. No, don't do that. He wasn't in the coaching boat. He was in the training mode, or maybe we could say he was coaching, but he did have the chance to stop and stop the game. Now he says, we're in the friendship mode. I'm not calling you servants, I'm calling you friends. I've told you everything from my Father. I no longer deal with you as servants. He didn't start here, but he got there. And ultimately, he'll be friends for eternity in the spirit realm. So, that's for you to consider. I think it's an important concept. I think a very good one. Children are indeed a blessing. I think they're a heritage from God. As I said, sadly, our society doesn't put the right value on them, nor does it emphasize the correct godly principles of character and the understanding of moral principles in terms of dealing with children. Why we're to obey God, why we're to obey His laws at all times. The Bible tells us God values His family name very highly. He tells us we're not to take His name in vain. We're not to take it in vain with our words, and we're not to take it in vain by the way we act, by the way we live. We need to live as though we're living up to our family name, which is God, the name of God. Proverbs chapter 22, we'll close with this, Proverbs chapter 22, verse 1 says, a good name is to be chosen rather than great riches, loving favor rather than silver and gold. Children that recognize your family is not like all the rest of the world are the kind of children that will uphold your family name. And they will bring honor to that name. And they're a tremendous blessing. They're a heritage of value beyond measure. In a sense, that helps us understand God's view of us, doesn't it? Doesn't that help us understand His view of His children? How He can call His children the apple of His eye. He can call them His jewels. He can call them precious things. They're a heritage to Him when we live up to that name. So it's important that we do that. Actually, I do have one other passage I want to turn to. I'd like to close with this one, actually. Joshua chapter 24. This has always been a very inspirational passage to me. It describes a family that was unified in its focus on God and was going to do right regardless of what everyone else did. Didn't matter what other families did. Here's what our family's going to do. This was a close family relationship. And it was a family that was going to do the right thing. The setting is Joshua was getting old. We're told later on that he died at the age of 110. But before that, he called the tribes of Israel, all the tribes of Israel, brought them out to Shechem, gave them a brief lesson of history, how God had brought them out of Egypt, settled them in the promised land. And then he said this to them in verse 14. He says, "Now therefore, fear the Lord, serve Him in sincerity and truth, and put away the gods which your fathers served on the other side of the river and in Egypt. Serve the Lord. And if it seems evil to you to serve the Lord, choose for yourself this day whom you will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served that were on the other side of the river, or the gods of the Amorites and the land in whose land you dwell. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord." In essence, he's telling them the same thing Moses did when he brought them out of right before they came into the promised land. He said, there's life and death, blessing and cursing, life and death. Choose, but choose life. I want you to choose the right thing. And Joshua is saying, I'm choosing life. No matter what you choose, my and my heritage, my household, we are choosing life. May each of us and our families make the same choice.